quite simply, I would say to you that what we have here in Alaska, as best I can understand, is a circumstance where some entity other than the government actually has control of the land. The Sagan Fox tribe has an aggressive land acquisition program, which is an investment in tribal government because the tribe's laws continue to apply to those properties as they acquire them. It's going to be interesting. Now, there are a number of Indian tribes in Oklahoma that have undertaken in the last several years to say that they are governments, that they intend to function as governments. There will be a whole number of tribal taxes. The court just ruled in our favor recently on license tags that were issued by the Sagan Fox tribe to people who are domiciled and are subject to the tribe's jurisdiction. They drive automobiles with tags from the Sagan Fox tribe. Now, there are people who laugh and they think that that's funny. And you really need to decide where you stand on that. Whether you see that as a function of governmental authority, or if the Sagan Fox just got out of hand and bought up from Wheaties whatever was left of those little tags that kids used to put on the back of their tricycle. The Sagan Fox take themselves very seriously. They have begun to negotiate various kinds of agreements where there are Indian housing projects. They have just offered to the county a substantial amount of money to pave the road because the road runs long and then it gets to the Indian-owned properties, it turns into a washboard. The Sagan Fox tribe has said there's no sense in us investing in a whole series of graders and road equipment. Why don't we just give money to the county that we've collected from our tax money so that they can maintain the road? And it has produced an interesting situation where nobody knows whether they can enter into a contract with an Indian tribe. You can enter into a contract with any little guy walking around in town, but you can't enter into one with an Indian tribe. And I think that'll probably be resolved here shortly, but I would just offer the experience of the Sagan Fox tribe, which is a smaller tribe in terms of numbers and in terms of property, but is a much bigger tribe. And I will lay down the Sagan Fox's laws, the Sagan Fox's attitudes, and the position where they move from to a government with anybody or any tribe in the United States. They see themselves in those terms. They see themselves as a government. They measure off what they do as a government in terms of the actions that they take. Everything that they view now becomes a function of law, a function of law. A function of law rather than a function of writing a proposal or writing a resolution to somebody. And let me tell you that I think that one of the good answers and the question and the reason for the taxation is that there's a balance sheet to the exercise of sovereignty. It does you no good to exercise sovereignty if what it does is you don't have the money to function. And when we get to the tribal courts, I think I can probably give some indication as to that. Because it is important for tribal governments to have basic monies. Now, the tribes that have forests, coal, oil and gas, and all those things, they don't have those problems. But for people who are in a more limited resource circumstance, they have to be, I think, a little more thoughtful about the directions that they go and the things that they can collect. So just on the tax, let me limit it to that. The Sagan Fox tribe collects 11 different kinds of taxes. They have sales tax, they have tax on tobacco, they have a tax on bingo. They have a 45% surcharge on bingo games. And they do not run the bingo game. I mean, as a government, they have chosen not to operate the bingo game. They pass the bingo laws of the Sagan Fox tribe, and if you want to run a bingo game, you come and get a license. All they're interested in is the revenue. They're not interested in running a bingo game. and on Monday, and there are certain kind of tax benefits by the way that they have structured their laws that flow to the bingo operator. So that they're, I would offer to you the experience of the Sac and Fox. Now, beginning next year, the amount of tax money that they have selected, and the reason I say there's a balance sheet to sovereignty is, over all of these years, the Sac and Fox tribe has maintained their governmental functions out of the revenues that they receive from oil and gas and other kinds of claims money and the interest off of their monies. They never collected one single dollar in taxes. Their services were limited because they didn't have the resources. Next year, I think that they will begin to fund their entire government out, not out of their claims money, not out of their income from their properties, but out of the tax monies that they have collected. So I would offer the Sac and Fox as a, one of these little bitty scroungy Indian tribes, who I would say is bigger in heart and bigger in direction and is organized to the direction that they intend to go as a part of this, as tribal government.
You said that they were going to buy land, and you said that that land would be under the jurisdiction of the tribal government. But when they buy land, do they place it in trust with the secretary, or do they hold it in fee, or what?
They place all of their land in trust. They have bought several tracts. Within the last year, they bought several tracts, which have been placed into trust. They intend to buy more and more tracts of land within what was, you know, their traditional area of operation. I don't think they've set a total goal on how much property that they intend to acquire, but they are beginning to look for lands that are strategically developed, situated for economic development, which are you know, attractive for various kinds of reasons.
What about the question of BIA oversight? In 1971, many Native leaders in Alaska rejected the idea of tribal governments because they were under the thumb of the BIA, and that was one of the marks against them. Well, what happens with the Sac and Fox and the BIA?
Well, let me give you just about 2 minutes worth of history on that. You know, I've served on the tribal council most of my adult life. The time that I was on the tribal council, and I'm no longer a member, was the evolution of the role of the Bureau, and I think that Reed and some of these others who have a day-to-day operation with tribes, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs used to be a significant resource to tribes in their development efforts. I think that most of the more organized and more able tribes have now, in fact, moved beyond what resources that the Bureau of Indian Affairs can offer in technical areas, such as in the formation of laws, the jurisdiction of the tribe, the courts, many of the functions of the tribe. I think the tribes are actually beyond the resources of a technical nature that the Bureau of Indian Affairs has to offer. So that role, I think, is largely in evolution as the tribe grows as a more powerful entity. Now, I remember we used to meet in a building where the ceiling was about five times as high and had a little gas stove on one end, and people used to come out and try to talk us into doing something, and we wouldn't be talked into it. And if you were on the tribal council long enough, you got to lease the tribal land one time anyway. That went in 2 years to people administering several million dollars worth of programs, but it still was a program agency. People were looking for federal dollars and other kinds of dollars to run programs. It was not a government. It didn't see itself as a government. It saw itself as a money hustler. And all states function that way, too. The states you know, mix the monies that they can receive from whatever sources. And I think that that's the direction that, let me give you an example of that. The state of Oklahoma, and I think one of the problems in the intergovernmental relations has been what states are going to view the Indian tribes as being. Because in a sense, sometimes they are competitors for jurisdiction directly. And we've had an in and out kind of, let me give you an example. The Oklahoma law says that an Indian tribal organization can get a tax-exempt tag for $5. Now that doesn't sound so bad, does it? And then there's a comma. It says, however, this will never serve to recognize them as a governmental entity of any kind for any reason, for whatever purpose. Yet the nature of the relationship between the tribes and the United States is one of a government to a government. And I really think that what Mr. Ashenbrenner is describing is a growing up of the relationships between the tribe and the states to define that relationship of not as the a bunch of Indians who belong to the Elks Club and who happen to own some money, and there's some kind of a weird corporation prowling around out there. And in their case, they own a lot of land, but as one where the Arizona and government becomes a recognition between the Navajo tribal government and the state governments, that they have legitimate reasons to deal as governments. And I think that that's the evolution of the of all of the relationships that I see developing between the tribes and the states, is to put that to rest. That we are dealing one government to another government. And I think it very easily solves the conceptual basis from which the state and the tribe operate with each other. I don't know whether I responded to or not.
One question I have, I'm glad you brought up weird corporations. In 1971, as times had it, I was over in Okinawa at the time, or I was in the Marine Corps, so I had no connection whatsoever with what was going on up here in Alaska with regard to ANCSA. When I left, it was still in the works, and I thought it was a good thing. But anyway, getting back to corporations, did it ever enter into anybody's mind the possibility of using IRA corporations? These are federally chartered corporations designed to go do business not only across the state, but across the nation. And if you believe everything you're supposed to read, supposedly they have the ability to work and do business worldwide.
Well, could I just answer that? We had a lot of folks here in March to talk about that, Sheldon. And I can summarize what I got out of it. The leading figure in the Senate when it came to ANCSA was the late Senator Henry Jackson. And he made it clear to Native leaders from Alaska, or at least his people did, his staff and so forth, that they were simply not willing to consider turning over all this money and all this land to tribal governments, IRA councils, traditional councils. So Alaska Native leaders, who were not greatly enamored of tribal government anyway, in some parts of Alaska it had a bad reputation, that is IRA governments, they felt they couldn't press the issue. I think that I'd like to leave it at that, because otherwise we go back into this history and never get out of it. Browning and then David.
The question I think you asked me directly is on the oversight. The Sac and Fox Constitution does not contain any approvals by the Secretary of the Interior for the approval of their laws. We have a lawsuit going now with one oil company who has maintained, and I guess the Supreme Court will tell us, that they're not going to pay their part of the oil and gas severance tax, not because the tribe doesn't have the power to impose it, but because the Secretary of the Interior didn't approve it, even though the tribe's constitution And we have a letter from the secretary that says he didn't have any power to approve it. So that it, a lot of times the oversight by the United States on matters other than relating to trust property and income in the governmental area comes by virtue of the fact that the tribe has placed the approval powers in its constitution over parts of its authority. Now, the United States has independent authority with respect to the tribe's trust property and income and things of that nature. So that to simplify that, I guess the Bureau of Indian Affairs approves leases. They approve various kinds of, the tribe has income that comes into what's called IIM accounts. They have to approve disbursements of those to the tribe. But I would not say that any tribe has found that so onerous that they can't deal with it. I mean, it rubs from time to time, you know, the approval by the United States of various activities. But I would not say that, see, that becomes a function of the nature of the relationship between the two. And I think in practical terms that most of the tribes have worked out a way of handling that as a, in other words, I don't think that in its present form that it has stunted the growth of the Sacking Fox tribe. I'll give you an interesting application of that. The Sacking Fox Constitution says that they have all power to transact whatever business and to act in all matters on which the tribe is empowered to act. Now, the courts have said that means that they can tax non-Indians, they can do all kinds of things. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs has taken a position that they can't hire a lawyer under that authority. Which I think is kind of cute, but you can tax people, you can issue motor vehicle tags, you can do all this sort of thing, but you got to have these several hurdles to. But I think those are more of a, those are more unusual on the oversight part of it than other parts. I had a conversation about this with some people from Maine several years ago. I just really think that people have overemphasized, and maybe that's what happened in 1971, the oversight of the BIA. I think we've blown that into some mystical, something that gets resolved, I think, on a practical standpoint.
David Getchies.
Yes, I have a follow-up question for Browning, too, on the same point. Question is whether oversight is overbearing when it's in the hands of the BIA. Browning has said it is not in these business contexts. What about when you have land that you want to have taken in trust? I know I've represented some tribes where the BIA has refused to take land in trust. The tribe can own it, but it's up to the Secretary of Interior whether it goes into trust or not. Have the Sacking Fox had problems with the BIA being resistant or dragging their feet on that question? That'd be very important, I think, to Alaska Natives.
Yeah, very important.
Well, the taking of land in trust by the United States is has become a more important issue in recent times, and the Sacking Fox, in my view, have had normal kinds of difficulties in having land put into trust, but they have always been successful, I guess is the way to say it. Sometimes there are problems with the title from the property that they purchased, which have to be resolved ahead of time. There are federal title standards that they have to meet. But the more recent issues that have come up about taking land into trust have been resistance from local, state and local governments. But I don't think that that's made any difference. And then the United States published regulations on under what circumstances they will take land into trust. I guess what it boils down to finally is that it becomes a matter of discretion, I think is what the statute says, so that it becomes one, I think, of tremendous importance. the only places I know that the United States has refused to take land into trust, and there may be many others, have been on the purchase of bingo property in cities to put bingo operations in. Most notably was one just recently with where the city of Duluth gave a tribe some land downtown because the bingo operations, I don't know how they are other places, but they are tremendous tourist attractions. They fill, you know, in the part of the state that I was telling you about where I'm from, you can imagine 7,000 people is a pretty nice little town. And so all of the tribes don't have any motels or anything like that. So, you know, they stay in the regular motels. I know of one motel that was about to go under, and the Indians saved it by bingo. Now, I'm not a bingo advocate, don't get me wrong. But I'm just saying to you that those are functions of the jurisdiction that have, many of the tribes could not keep their buildings open. They'd not be able to buy gasoline for their cars if it weren't for the revenue generating activities that they've had through bingo. Now the great big tribes that have got 44 to 50 to 60 million dollars a year income, they don't have that trouble. I'm trying to talk to you about all of the rest of us. And everybody, to us pitiful ones, that you're probably closer to than the Navajos, and some of these have huge incomes and things of that nature. So the trust land is, I think, extremely important. But I don't know of any tribes who have wanted to acquire land that was not in trust. But under the Trade and Intercourse Act, I assume that if you acquire land as a tribe, even if you use money as you got from a car wash, it becomes the land of the tribe and is subject to those same things. If you have a bake sale or pie supper and use the money to buy it and it comes in the name of the tribe, then it seems to me that those same restrictions come along, and I have so proved in two cases where they came to take people's buildings away from them.
The point that David Getchies made is important in Alaska, because the Secretary of Interior in the spring of this year was in Alaska and indicated, I don't know whether this was a statement of policy intended to be etched in concrete, but he indicated that he would not be willing to accept in trust conveyances of Native corporation land to tribal governments. I think that's what he said. We're going to adjourn for coffee in just 1 second. I've got the names of some people who want to speak. When we come back after coffee, I wish that some of you would tell me whether there are any examples of tribal authority in the lower 48 being exercised over fish and game on tribal lands, on state lands, and on federal lands. And Charlie, I'll give you the last question before the break, if we can make it short.
What I would like to ask, our problem in Alaska is tribal in nature. It deals with land and other cultures. So maybe to correct the mess of ANCSA, what we probably need is an authority like the conflict between Navajo and Hopi. And so that we can go back to Congress so that when they first commandeered us to the conference table, we were not asked. So we were commandeered at the table, and I feel that the Hopi and the Navajo Land Conflict Authority is probably the correct way for us to resolve these problems of equity, jurisdiction, and then to examine the preempted field. And here is a case where the Alaska Natives were preempted by their membership, of their membership by Congress. And so this feel of federal preemption and tribal preemption, when they gave us to the state of Alaska without our permission, I feel that the preemptive powers of the federal government are as such that we can get back to them and to resolve some of the mess, some of the authoritative, authoritarian, totalitarian regimes that they had imposed upon us on ANCSA. And so how did Oklahoma, New Mexico, Arizona, and Alaska are very similar in character. We have a lot of the IRA councils here are executive order tribes, just like Oklahoma. And Oklahoma and Alaska came in as tribes on the same bill. And so what happened to Alaska, Browning, is that they had created these tribal governments and failed to define Section 2 of the Indian Reorganization Act, which is the basis of the boundary of these governments. So what we have in Alaska is we have IRA enclaves whose extraterritorial powers are as large as the capacity of the United States, because the boundaries have not been defined. So between the boundary conflict of the Hopis and the Navajos, since states themselves, by themselves, and the Bureau of Land Management do not resolve boundaries, I think that we have a major federal question here that we can take back to Congress to resolve the boundaries of these tribal governments, these instrumentalities that have been in existence for 50 years. And so we were commandeered into since ANCSA is not a jurisdictional act, that we can probably now come in and then to create an Alaska Native authority where membership is defined by those people who are affected on a vote. Say if Sea Alaska shareholders were given the privilege to make that determination of the infrastructures that are available, which do they desire? Had the democratic process come to maturity, the mess that we are in today would not be here. And so the federal government came back in to resolve tribal conflict between the Hopis and the Navajos. And I am of the opinion that the Department of Interior and Congress warrant we have an issue where preemption had occurred without consent, but at the same time that the fuzzy trust responsibility gray area is showing here, and because the Secretary of Interior approves our attorney, the normal attorney-client relationship do not exist here, so we are at a disadvantage. When the Secretary of Interior creates a problem and says that he's going to give you a hostage and then you are the hostage because you don't have counsel, when you become a hostage to the tribe, a hostage to the United States, Vice Secretary of Interior, and he has made this mess without and have preempted you to the state government, where does one go?
Okay, well, let's reflect on that over coffee, and let's take a 5-minute break.
Mm-hmm.
We could ask David Getchies to take a stab at the question I asked about jurisdiction over fish and game. And then I'm going to ask Charles Wilkinson to say something about taxation. So, David, would you start off then?
Yes, I think the question that that you posed before we went on the break was the question of whether tribes could regulate off their reservations and who they could regulate on their reservations with respect to hunting and fishing. And it is true that a number of tribes regulate both members and non-members of the tribe on the reservation. And it's also true that many tribes regulate their own members off their reservations. But there's a special problem as it relates to Alaska that needs to be pointed out. The ability to regulate off the reservation, regulate members off the reservation, and regulate members and non-members on the reservation springs from some very special relationships that may not be present in Alaska. The ability to regulate non-members, non-Indians, on the reservation is only present where certain conditions are existent. The Supreme Court, in dealing with the question, said that the regulation has to relate to the political integrity, economic security, or social welfare of the tribe, and that leaves it wide open for courts to deal with it. I would think in a subsistence economy, you could show that regulating non-natives on native land was essential to economic security and some of these other factors. The problem is, what is the reservation where regulation is possible? And I think that that's a question that needs to be dealt with not only in the context of hunting and fishing, but in the context of all types of regulation like taxation, which Charles will address. Similarly, the question of off-reservation regulation arises. Unless you know what the reservation is, you don't know what off-reservation is. Off-reservation regulation, in any event, is only possible by Indian tribes where there's a special law or treaty that gives them rights off the reservation. Unfortunately, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act extinguished special hunting and fishing rights to the extent they existed at the time of the act, and that is a serious problem in trying to make an argument that there is an ability of the tribe, village as the case may be, to regulate beyond an area that could be defined as a reservation or Indian country. So while it's possible in the lower 48, it's possible only because of these special laws for off-reservation, for regulation of non-members.
Charles Wilkinson.
I'll just briefly mention some of the principles of taxation in the lower 48 in the hope that they'll be of use to Alaska Natives here. State and tribal jurisdiction is geographically based, and so for many purposes, Indian reservations are extraterritorial to the states, and they are areas within which only the tribes can regulate. You define the geographic area by the term David mentioned, Indian country, and in the classic Indian law terms, perhaps the most fundamental issue for governance for Alaska Natives is whether Indian country exists here now, and if so, how much? And similarly, if you wish to extend your self-governing authority, what you one mechanism, and maybe the most likely one, would be to establish Indian country under federal law. Indian country generally is described as all land within the exterior boundaries of a federally recognized Indian reservation. that includes non-Indian land, non-native land, so that if you have a checkerboarded reservation, all land within it, not just tribal land, is Indian country. The second definition doesn't relate to a reservation, but is dependent Indian communities. And certainly there's, it seems to me, a live argument today that village areas, some boundary, is a dependent Indian community, but that hasn't been resolved. For the purposes of this commission, certainly one recommendation could be that areas around villages be determined by federal statute to be Indian country. Now, if that were to be done, and there were a parallel concept up here to what is done in the lower 48, you would have roughly this situation in regard to taxation. And I might say that many of these, or some of these propositions, are not completely settled, and you can have many permutations here that could get very technical, but I'm going to avoid that because I'm not sure it's important for our purposes. There are three kinds of taxes that have come up here: state, federal, and tribal. To look at state taxes first, Indian land, trust land within Indian country, is not subject to state tax. Now, a state property tax. We need to make an important footnote there that ties into a subject we were talking about yesterday. In fact, the most important use of state tax funds is for education. The state can't collect that tax money, but the federal government pays in lieu taxes through an impact aid program that goes up and down as to its funding. But the idea is to try to compensate local school districts so they will have operating funds even though they can't collect a property tax. So Indian lands are tax exempt. Secondly, as far as state income taxes are concerned, they don't apply to Indians within Indian country. And then third, sales taxes don't apply to sales to Indians within Indian country. In some cases, if a sale is made, say, of cigarettes to a non-Indian in Indian country, that is subject to state taxation. So that the direction the court is going is it seems, is to exempt from state taxation any tax that would fall on an Indian, and to exempt, in some cases, non-Indians who operate within Indian country. As Browning suggested earlier, there are definitely situations in which a tribe can hold out a tax advantage to a non-Indian corporation within Indian country, and that can be an inducement. It is marginal in many cases, but it can be important for some businesses to bring them, give them an incentive to come to Indian country. Second is the area of federal taxation. The states have limited authority to tax Indians within Indian country. The federal government doesn't have any limit on its authority. It can tax as it wishes. But in defining taxpayers, Congress has not included Indian tribes, so that the federal income tax scheme simply doesn't apply to federally recognized Indian tribes. They are not taxpayers.
The tribes are the people living
The tribes. Now, individual Indians within Indian country are exempted from federal taxation if they receive income that is directly derived from trust property, such as an allotment. And so, and there's been a long body of case law there, and so if a person is grazing cattle or selling timber or farming on their own allotment, that is not subject to federal taxation. It's trust property. On the other hand, if you run a motel on on your land, the income from the allottee's income probably is taxable. There is now a case in the Ninth Circuit involving the sale of reindeer products. The Alaska Natives are arguing that the reindeer are held in trust and that therefore the sale of the products is not taxable. That hasn't been decided yet. On the other hand, if an individual Indian is working within Indian country and receives income that isn't tied to an allotment, that is subject to federal income tax, but not state tax, state income tax. Then the third area is tribal taxation. Tribes have broad authority to tax their own members, and so far anyway, quite broad authority to tax non-Indians doing business within Indian country. And so tribes have successfully, in some cases, taxed, for example, extraction of minerals by corporations from within Indian country. None of us here would make this out to be some magic body of law, but there is a range of protections that are now getting quite well established that have allowed tribes to raise revenue in this manner. Similarly, as Browning suggested at some length, tribes are able to operate outside the regulatory jurisdiction of the states and so are not subject to state environmental laws, state laws regulating bingo, and can offer, if they choose to extend it, marginal incentives, sometimes more than that, to people wishing to locate in Indian country. I want to address very briefly a question that Sheldon Kachetag raised, and I think Charlie Edwardson has been talking about too, and I just want to give my own perspective on it. In addition to Senator Jackson's opposition to tribal entities when ANCSA went through it, it seems to me there was another reason that Alaska Natives did not end up with tribal entities and some of the potential they have. And that was in 1969, 70, 71, when ANCSA was being determined. The truth is that at that moment in history, offering out the possibility of tribal powers wasn't that attractive. And I would rephrase an answer Larry gave to a question. He was asked by Sheldon, well, was the Navajo tribe doing all these things in 1971? And I would answer that by picking up on a concept Larry was using. The Navajo tribe in 1971 had all the potential power it has today, all the potential power. Many of its divisions existed on paper. The Navajo tribe was not exercising as much actual power as it was today. And if somehow you can measure the actual exercise of power, the amount of taxes you raise, the amount of regulation you produce, the amount of informal sanctions, the amount of action in your tribal court, if you could somehow measure that, Indian tribes have just gone way up over the last 12, 13, 14, 15 years. In fact, the truth is a major case that David Case referred to yesterday, the McClanahan decision, came down in 1973, and that was really the first case in modern times that explained that Indian tribes are, for most purposes, extraterritorial to the states, and they can govern themselves. My own guess is that even if the McClanahan case, which was a beginning point compared with some of the decisions that have come down since, that if you had McClanahan available to you in 1971, I think Alaska Natives would have seen the potential more clearly, and we would have had a different result in ANCSA. So again, I'm not trying to make too much of this. I don't think anybody from the lower 48 is trying to say, we've got a terrific system, it's perfect, it ought to be adopted up here. That's not any of our intentions. What we are saying, though, is that there's a real difference between corporate powers and governmental powers. Governmental powers can be exercised in an informal way, and Spud Williams talked about this yesterday, and I agree with that. But governmental authority means that you can be substantially free of the values of a state, because that's what jurisdiction is and governmental authority is social values, an important part. And that potential is there, and that it was only potential in 1971, and the law has moved ahead substantially since then. And I at least am one, I'm very reluctant to criticize the contract that ANCSA was in 1971, because I think that the world as it existed then was very different than it is now. And I think for all of you, the really important issue is not that ANCSA was a mistake. By today's lights, maybe it was in some respects, but how to rectify it. Those decisions were made in a very different setting than we have today.
Yeah. Rosita? Thanks, Charles. Yes.
Well, protection of the environment is a major priority for hunting and fishing people, such as in Alaska. And from our Alaskan experience, it seems that there is an inherent conflict between development and protection of the environment. And the question that I have is, I wonder how this conflict resolves itself or transforms itself when tribes act both as a government and also as a business entity. And perhaps Browning Pipestem or some other